Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's rulings from the Supreme Court that will have a profound impact on the survival of labor unions and on undermining the separation of church and state by extending protections limited to churches to private for-profit corporations, making an employer's religious beliefs more important than an employee's rights. Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, joins us to discuss the latter and the implications of this radical ruling by the court's conservative corporatist majority that expands the powers of closely held corporations like Cargill, Mars, and Coke Industries, who already account for 52% of private employment and 51% of private sector output over their employees. Then we'll examine the other Supreme Court ruling against public sector unions that exempts Medicaid-funded home care workers and other workers who are not seen by the conservative corporatist justices as full-fledged public employees from joining unions and paying dues. William Gould, a Stanford law professor specializing in labor and discrimination law, who previously served as chairman of the National Labor Relations Board, joins us to discuss this nose-of-the-camel ruling that opens the way for corporations and their representatives on the Supreme Court to go after the foundation of the court's Abood ruling that allows unions to collect dues and thus be viable. Then finally, China expert Perry Link, who was banned from China because he was the recipient of the Politburo's leaked Tiananmen papers, joins us from Taiwan to discuss the referendum in Hong Kong that was a protest vote against China's encroachment on democracy in the former British colony that has a tenuous one-country, two-systems democratic autonomy from the mainland. We will also discuss the Chinese president's recent pledge to India and Myanmar that China does not subscribe to the notion that a country is bound to seek hegemony when it grows in strength. And joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Courts of Appeals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
And the Hobby Lobby case that came out today, the ruling that came out today, am I correct in characterizing it as a radical ruling that could have enormous implications, given particularly in terms of separation of church and state, because it appears to me that it extends protections that have been previously limited to churches to private for-profit corporations, making the employer's religious beliefs more important than an employee's rights?
Well, it is an absolutely unprecedented, very broad ruling, despite the conservative majority's best attempts to make it seem as if they were issuing a narrow, specific ruling. And I think Justice Ginsburg got it right when she started her dissent by saying that it was a startlingly broad ruling by the court. Never in the history of our nation have for-profit corporations been understood to share in the protections of religious free exercise that living, breathing human beings enjoy. And, you know, your point about how this privileges the rights of corporations over the rights of the employees who work for those companies, I think is spot on. You know, the employees who work for these companies may have very different beliefs about how to live their lives than the folks who own Hobby Lobby and Conestoga would, the particular companies involved in this suit. And moreover, the fact that this could apply to other corporations, you know, makes the implications of the ruling very broad and very troubling.
But the other thing that the court is saying in its ruling, in many areas of the press is being sort of dutifully reported as not being much of a change and therefore nothing to be particularly concerned about, is that this is a narrow ruling that only expands the powers of closely held corporations. Well, I'm looking at a list here of America's largest private companies, and they account for 52% of all private employment and 51% of all private sector output. And we've got Cargill, Coke Industries, Chrysler, GMAC Financial Services, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Mars, Bechtel, Ernst & Young, Cox Enterprises, Toys R Us, Enterprise Rent-A-Car, SC Johnson & Company, and so on and so on. So, again, I just don't think that this is quite as modest a ruling as both the conservative majority and the press are trying to suggest.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, first of all, the court doesn't actually say that the ruling's reasoning doesn't apply to publicly traded companies. They just say that it is unlikely that such companies would ever bring a claim, and it's improbable that they would ever be successful with such a claim. But even with respect to closely held corporations, you're exactly right. Closely held doesn't mean small. And these privately owned companies employ hundreds of thousands of people across the country. And so, you know, we could be talking about substantial numbers of employees who have to have their rights and benefits determined by the religious views of the folks who own those companies. And that's just contrary to our American tradition when it comes to our diverse religious society and the way that we think of how, you know, look, we are a country where the majority of Americans consider themselves to be religious people. But when we engage in society, in our diverse society, we don't have all of our activities treated as if they're church activities. You know, that's how we engage in this pluralistic society, which with our rich mosaic of different faiths. And I think the court's ruling today really does threaten to upset that balance, and I find it very concerning.
Well, apparently 9 out of 10 businesses are closely held in this country, and the IRS defines a closely held corporation as having more than half the value of its stock owned by 5 or fewer individuals. And of course, you know, when you just mentioned some of the big companies like Mars, the candy giant, they have 70,000 workers, and Cargill has more than 140,000 workers. So this is really going to affect the American workplace.
Exactly. And, you know, and the majority on the Supreme Court focused on how when you start a business, you don't check your religious liberty at the door. But at the same time, when you punch a clock for a corporation, you don't check your religious liberty at the door. And the people who work for these companies might have very different religious beliefs and views on how to live their lives than the people who own their company. I mean, you know, when you sign up to work for one of these companies, you might not even know the religious views of the people who are employing you. This is very different from if you're being employed by an explicitly religious corporation. I mean, an explicitly religious organization like a church or a school or something like that. Your expectations are different. And here we're talking about something that is very important to women and their families, the ability to make decisions about what is the safest and most effective form of contraception and family planning for that particular woman, which is a decision that, you know, the experts who came up with these regulations decided was something that should be based on medical reasons and not based on what is most affordable to you. That's why there's no copay involved in the Affordable Care Act regulation, and a decision that, frankly, is between a woman, a doctor, and her God.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wider, who's the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. So as the dissenting justices Stephen Breyer and Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, how does the court divine which religious beliefs are worthy of accommodation and which are not? And again, because it was brought by a fundamentalist Christian group, a family that owned Hobby Lobby, this means in terms of the broad spectrum of religions, what does it mean? Are now employees going to have to find out the religious beliefs of their bosses and maybe if they want to get promoted, convert to Judaism or Islam or Buddhism or whatever?
Well, I think that this is where it gets interesting that the majority tried to make its ruling as limited as possible because they say that, oh, this reasoning as it applies to contraception doesn't mean that blood transfusions or vaccinations, that those things are in play or that you'll be able to claim religious exemptions from anti-discrimination law. But that gets into exactly what you just brought up. Is the court saying that religious objections to those laws are somehow inferior to religious objections to contraception? And the court really has tried to avoid getting involved in being the arbiter of what religious beliefs are appropriately sincere to gain an exemption from laws that are generally applicable to society at large. So this really, in trying to make the ruling seem narrow, and I think Justice Ginsburg is absolutely right in her dissent, that even though they say it's narrow, there's no reason why these other aspects of the law are not open to challenge under religious beliefs. But in doing so, the majority really, frankly, puts the courts in a more intrusive role with respect to religious beliefs than it was before.
Well, that gets to the question of judicial activism, doesn't it? And it's just so obvious that the shoe is on the other foot here. I mean, for the longest time, conservatives in this country have been telling us, railing against judicial activism on the part of liberal justices, but there's been no evidence of that for decades. And on the other side, there's ample evidence that many, if not most, of the rulings coming out of the Supreme Court conservative corporatist majority have benefited big corporations like Citizens United. There's no question that it's unleashed untold amounts of unaccountable, unlimited amounts of money into our political system. The other ruling that we're going to be talking about in a minute clearly threatens to defund unions, which are already weak and on the waning. There's only 8% of the private sector workforce is even unionized, and about 30-something percent of the public sector that's under attack. And by the way, they often give money to the Democrats. The rulings on suppressing the vote or allowing the vote to be suppressed in the South, which was prevented by the Voting Rights Act, an important provision of which was repealed. I could go on, but it seems to me that there's a pattern here.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that, frankly, the role of the courts is to be active in protecting the rights that our Constitution and other laws guarantee for people. But for some reason, the Roberts Court seems to be much more solicitous of what it views to be corporate rights than, as you said, the rights of everyday Americans to cast their vote at the ballot box free from discrimination. And it's particularly troubling in this case when the court is discovering for the first time in more than 200 years a right to free exercise that they somehow think that corporations have, which our founders certainly didn't think that for-profit corporations had, and which no Supreme Court ruling had ever recognized prior to the ruling today. So when the court goes against American constitutional tradition and its own precedent, then I think that's very troubling, especially when you're talking about the rights of corporations as opposed to the rights of employees and women and their families who just want the benefits under the Affordable Care Act to which they are legally entitled.
So, in other words, Citizens United, which allows corporations as persons in law freedom to spend unlimited amounts of money, that's now being extended in terms of the religious provisions of the First Amendment?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think, you know, as bad as Citizens United was, I think, you know, Americans and, you know, folks can think of corporations as engaging in speech a lot more easily than they can think of corporations exercising religion. You know, I mean,
only religion as it pertains to birth control.
Yeah. And, you know, and the court tries to say that this is a decision, you know, good for this ride only, which on the one hand, I sort of hope they're right because I don't want this extended into other areas of the law. But on the other hand, that's kind of offensive that somehow, you know, oh, when it comes to women's access to contraception, somehow there's a lesser government interest in that public health, important public health reasoning, whereas, you know, vaccinations, oh, well, that's different.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wider, who's the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. So the problem with these rulings is that they are the Supreme Court, right? I mean, you just scratch your head. You think, well, maybe somebody will come to their senses and recognize the inconsistency and the portent here or the possibility of terrible abuses coming down the line. But what can be done to fix this, apart from the fact that people on the left and progressives in this country don't tend to vote, particularly in midterm elections, and they wake up one day and realize that conservative presidents in this country have been able to, they've controlled the White House more often than not, and if the Republicans take the Senate, it'll be all but impossible for Obama to put up a nominee if he has to, and so on.
Well, fortunately, this case is an interpretation of a statute, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, as opposed to some of these campaign finance rulings, which were explicitly under the First Amendment. And when it comes to the Constitution, the Supreme Court is the last word on that interpretation. But it is theoretically possible for Congress to change the law to make it clear that they did not intend corporations to have free exercise rights under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But as you and I'm sure your listeners know, good luck trying to get anything through Congress these days.
So is there any more shoes to drop before they go off on their vacation? These were the big ones, right? Today.
Well, this is the last day of the term, so these are the last decisions of the term, and the justices will go off to their summer vacations, and the rest of us will try to parse out what their decisions mean.
And if you're a woman working for one of these big corporations that are supposedly so closely held, they represent 52% of the workplace and something like 9 out of 10 private companies in this country, then tough luck getting covered by birth control. It's entirely up to your boss and his or her religious beliefs, whether or not couldn't a head of a corporation who just wants to be cheap say, I'm suddenly born-again Christian or Catholic, Opus Dei fundamentalist, and I don't believe in birth control, so tough luck.
One of my friends on Facebook said, what is the religion that objects to the most things so I can save the most money as a business owner? But with respect to the women who work for these companies, the government, the Obama administration, I know, has said that they are looking for ways to ensure that the full range of FDA-approved contraception is provided through the insurance plans. But if the government does not step in to somehow make that happen, then if women want these other forms of contraception, then they are likely faced with the prospect of paying for it out of pocket. And as Justice Ginsburg noted in her dissent, an IUD, which is one of the most effective and safest forms of contraception, particularly for women who've had children, that can cost about a full month's pay if you work on a minimum wage job, and it's very hard for people to make that decision. So women are faced with a difficult decision here under the court's ruling today.
Well, Elizabeth Wydry, thank you very much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wydry, who is the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Court of Appeals. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a former chairman of the National Labor Relations Board about the Supreme Court's nose of the camel ruling that could in the future prevent unions from collecting dues.
It is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last, for the times they are a-changing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Gould, who's a Stanford Law professor specializing in labor and discrimination law, who previously served as chairman of the National Labor Relations Board. His most recent book is Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Gould.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
And this Supreme Court ruling that came down today, Harris versus Quinn, it seems the press are referring to it as a limited ruling. However, in her dissent, Justice Elena Kagan said this decision against the union would radically restructure the way workplaces across the country are run. And the decision itself, from what I can tell, is a major blow to unions trying to organize Medicaid-funded home care workers and other workers who, in the eyes of this corporatist conservative majority on the Supreme Court, aren't full-fledged public employees. So what do they mean by that?
Well, this is a new term that Justice Alito seems to have devised for the occasion. As Justice Kagan pointed out, the state and the customers, in this case for these home care providers, are joint employers in the sense that they're both involved in the employment relationship. But the holding itself, of course, involves this particular group of home care providers, and thus, in that sense, is a narrow one. And given the fact that the court felt compelled to devise this new special category of employees, public employees, but make no mistake about it, the reasoning of the court is ambitious and expansive and very much in favor of non-union employees who are objecting to payment of dues to the union, which represents a majority of the employees in their workplace. The court is unsympathetic to agency fee agreements wherever they are in the public sector, indeed under its reasoning to some in the private sector as well.
Well, is this then laying the groundwork for the conservative corporatist majority on this court to further erode public employee unions?
Oh, undoubtedly. I don't think there's any question about that. The court says that the problems involved with budgets and pensions, which cause the court, the public economic burdens, in the court's view, were not clearly perceived at the time of the earlier Supreme Court rulings promoting collective bargaining, promoting unions, and promoting agency shop agreements, the Abood decision in 1977. This is why the court says that Abood itself stands on what it calls shaky foundations.
Well, but that's another way, isn't it, of saying that we don't believe in that workers in this country should have a livable wage. I mean, what are they saying?
Well, the court is clearly hostile to the idea of unions in the workplace, particularly unions in the workplace in the public sector, which, after all, are an important part of any kind of democratic society. The court says that the public sector is different from the early cases in which union security agreements were accepted because politics is more infused into the public sector, and that the unions are able to manipulate the elected representatives, something they say is not present in the or not present to the same extent in the private sector. They point out, they refer to all these cases that we've had where the court has tried to distinguish between subject matter that the unions bargain about involving employment conditions, on the one hand, which previously were regarded as legitimate, and on the other hand, subject matter which is political in nature, which the court has for some time regarded as illegitimate. They say, well, it's difficult to sort this kind of thing out. It's difficult to find a demarcation line between these two concepts. And this in itself, Justice Alito says, highlights the inadequacy of the previous Supreme Court decisions, which so much promoted agency shop agreements in the public sector.
Again, I'm speaking with William Gould, who's a Stanford Law professor specializing in labor and discrimination law, who previously served as chairman of the National Labor Relations Board. His most recent book is Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. But again, I'm trying to understand that reasoning on the part of the corporatist conservative majority, because it seems fairly, if not fraudulent, certainly thin, because first of all, they're the people who put forth the Citizens United decision that has enabled corporations to secretly spend billions and billions in our political world. Of course, they say that unions can too, but unions are all but extinct in this country. In the private sector, they only represent 8% of all workers. And in the public sector, they're only a little over 30%. So what is this power that we're talking about in terms of a level playing field? Corporations, thanks to the Supreme Court, have unlimited power to anonymously spend unlimited amounts of money. And somehow unions representing the private sector down to 8%, and those representing the public employees don't have a right to participate in our politics?
Well, indeed, the court 2 years ago, in a case coming out of California here, Knox against California, indicated that the rights of dissident employees who objected to having their dues spent for political purposes trumped the rights of workers who had, the majority of workers who had voted for a union as exclusive bargaining representative. And this decision brings that view announced 2 years ago by Justice Alito home once again. Traditional rationale for agency shop agreements, agency fair share agreements, has been that the union has an obligation to bargain on behalf of all employees, be they union or not union, non-union, on the same basis, the same conditions of employees, the same conditions of employment. So the view has been that you should be able to pay for what you get. And if you are not compelled to pay, then there's an incentive not to be a union member, and there's an incentive to undercut the whole exclusive bargaining representative status concept, which has been promoted by labor law in this country traditionally. Justice Alito just kind of blows that away by saying that, well, in this particular case, the union really wasn't able to do very much for the workers because the wage was fixed by the state. Although, as Justice Kagan pointed out, the union had negotiated some good fringe benefits for the employees that it represented. He said also that the union was not able to affect the discharge of employees, to protect employees against discharge. Again, a matter that is disputed by Justice Kagan. The traditional view of collective bargaining is that collective bargaining is supposed to be wide open. There's no ironclad formula imposed upon workers and employers at the workplace. Now, the court seems to be imposing an ironclad formula and seems to be saying, well, it's going to weigh the extent to which the union is able to affect the employees' conditions of employment before it will even recognize the point that by allowing non-union people to object to the payment of dues is an incentive for non-unionism because it creates unionism on the cheap. There's an overriding theme here that Justice Kagan, I think, pointed out very well, and that is she said that the majority opinion authored by Justice Alito has sort of adopted the philosophy that it will throw everything against the wall and see if some of it sticks. That's what they've done here. They've even said, there's no concern that we have here about having to have good agency fair share agreements in the interest of promoting peace between unions and employers. Because here, the court says, the employees don't work in one common facility. They're all over the place. And therefore, since they don't have contact with one another, it's unlikely that there will be any kind of disruption of industrial peace. Whatever argument can be pigeonholed into an anti-union, an anti-collective bargaining position is adopted by the court. That's why this opinion, while it presents a holding which is limited to the so-called partial public employees, is a very ambitious one and really puts the handwriting on the wall, so to speak, for public sector workers throughout the United States.
Well, the importance of these home care workers, particularly given that they're Medicaid funded, in other words, you and I ultimately and all the taxpayers fund them. According to Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, in denouncing this ruling, he's saying that home care is one of the fastest growing industries. Its workers do backbreaking, thankless work, often for low wages. And by forming a union, these workers are helping to combat income inequality and the rise of low wage jobs.
So, and Illinois here was acting sensibly by involving the customer, the elderly, the infirm, the disabled, in evaluation of these employees, because the personal suitability of the employees and the valuable work that they do is so important. The court turns around the involvement of customers in the employment relationship and turns it against the unions and the workers and deprives them of rights that were viewed as valuable in a different era.
Again, I'm speaking with William Gould, who's a Stanford law professor specializing in labor and discrimination law, who previously served as chairman of the National Labor Relations Board. His most recent book is Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. Well, clearly, the way that corporations and their enablers and helpers, like the conservative corporatist majority on the Supreme Court, the way that they frame their attacks on labor are not that they don't want unions altogether, which is clearly the case, but that they think that collecting dues is somehow a form of coercion, and they're using that as a wedge issue. And when you have a ruling that questions the foundations of the Abood ruling that allows for unions, whether they're public, partially public, or private, to collect dues. If they're going after that, they're going after the very heart of the viability of unions.
Well, one of the many ironies in this ruling is this. In the past decade, on a number of occasions, the Supreme Court has said again and again that public employees who have grievances against public employers, even when those grievances cost the employer money and affect the taxes of the public, they have no First Amendment right to protest. This began particularly with the so-called Garcetti case a decade ago. But now, these public employees who object to unions, well, they have a First Amendment right to protest. They have the right to object, to pay dues, and not to be coerced, even though other public employees, when they attempted to assert First Amendment rights freedom of association, free speech rights honored here in this decision, they were denied. Now they're recognized. And there is a basic inconsistency. The court said, there's no inconsistency between the earlier public sector cases because these cases involve large amounts of money. They involve pensions. They involve budgets. And of course, Justice Kagan says, well, what is the demarcation line? We had amounts of money involved in connection with public employee grievances when they asserted First Amendment rights against their public employer. What's the degree of difference that the court establishes between the amount of money involved in those cases and the amount of money that the taxpayer will have to pay for involved in these cases involving collective bargaining? And there is no logical and justifiable demarcation line between these two groups of cases. And the bottom line is that whatever policy supports collective bargaining is going to be discouraged by this court. And if this court is, as presently constituted, faces a future case involving employees who cannot be regarded as so-called partial public employees, there isn't any doubt that its reasoning will lead to the invalidation of agency shop, agency fee, fair share agreements in the public sector throughout the country.
And William Gould, that of course is the Abood ruling, and it does feel like this ruling today is the nose of the camel in terms of going after this ruling. Justice Kagan said at least it's better the ruling is better than it might be, but she's implying that I think that the battle's not over. And I take it you don't think the battle's over.
No, I don't think the battle is over, but I think that the fix is in, so to speak. If the same court is confronted with the public sector issue in a more pristine form, it will follow the lead that has been established today. Now, we don't know whether President Obama or whether a future president after 2016 will have appointments which could affect the course of the court. That's the big proviso that always has to be tacked on here. But given the fact that the filibuster continues to apply to and pertain to appointments to the Supreme Court, notwithstanding the compromise of last summer, the fact is that President Obama will have a very difficult time and presumably his successor, if it is a Democrat, will have a very difficult time making appointments to the court, which could affect and alter the course of this decision.
Well, that's why I think that you can make a reasonable case that this court are conservative political operatives. They're keeping the Republican Party alive with Citizens United by enabling voter suppression and by trying to destroy public sector unions so that they can't be a funding base for the Democratic Party. All of this is going to help them in the upcoming elections. And if they win the Senate, then the Republicans will have even more ability to stop any appointments that Obama might make in his lame duck period. So it's just
for years, they railed against what they claimed was an activist court, the Warren Court. But the Warren Court's decisions, so-called activism, pale into insignificance compared to what this court engages in.
Well, William Gould, I thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with William Gould, who's a Stanford Law professor specializing in labor and discrimination law, who previously served as chairman of the National Labor Relations Board. His most recent book is Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and go to Asia to speak about the referendum in Hong Kong and the new Chinese president's assurances that China is not interested in becoming a hegemonic power.
She's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I would.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Perry Link, who holds the Chancellorial Chair for Innovative Teaching Across Disciplines and is also a Professor of Comparative Literature and Foreign Languages at the University of California, Riverside. He is one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people. And in the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked from the Politburo by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protests in June of 1989. Perry Link was blacklisted by the Chinese government in 1996 and joins us from Taiwan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Perry Link. I wanted to talk to you about two things that are happening in the neighborhood. Obviously, you're banned from China. You can't go there, but Hong Kong has had a referendum where 80,000 people showed up. It was a non-binding referendum, but the citizens of Hong Kong are concerned that Beijing has pledged to Hong Kong that the voters can choose their chief executive in the 2017 election, but only from a list of candidates selected by the nominating committee. And of course, people are afraid that China will use that committee to screen out candidates it disapproves of. Under this system that they have in China, the tenuous one country, two systems, democratic autonomy from the mainland, I take it this is a way for the people to fight back against the gradual encroachment of China over their freedom.
Yes, that's right. This has been going on since the 1980s when London and Beijing negotiated the handover. Beginning in 1984, they had something called the Basic Law that was ambiguous in key ways. It did not rule out universal suffrage that the Democrats were pushing for even then, but it didn't lay out a roadmap of how it would happen either. And you know how politicians are. They like to leave controversial things alone so that they can get the law passed, and that's what happened. And then in the 80s, the Hong Kong Democrats pushed, when the British were still there, for universal suffrage. And when the one country, two systems formula kicked in officially in 1997, then they had to deal with Beijing in this. And several times again, in the first decade of this century, made pushes for this, especially in 2008, and came pretty close to getting universal suffrage. Universal suffrage here means two things. It means for the chief executive and for the members of the legislative council. And Beijing's response has always been, as you just pointed out, that we will nominate who the candidates are. And besides, voting is not by universal suffrage, but by interest group blocks, where unions and teachers and so on have blocks of votes, and this too can be more easily manipulated. So it gets more and more intense, and what we're seeing now is that a determined group of Democrats in Hong Kong, including professors and some in the Catholic Church and some very prominent businessmen like Jimmy Lai, the owner of the Next Media Group, is involved, are really mean what they're doing now. And they did this referendum to show that the public backs them. And in the next few months, this event, the so-called Occupy Central, where there will be a sit-in in the Central District in Victoria, the city in Hong Kong, might happen. So it's all coming to a head. But it's been in the offing for 30 years, really.
Well, of course, the Chinese government have repeatedly condemned Occupy Central, and of course, they're dismissing this referendum as illegal. But obviously, they're borrowing from the Occupy movement here in the United States, which unfortunately has fizzled. But what's your sense whether or not this Occupy movement's going to fizzle?
It's not going to fizzle in the sense that the ones behind it will go ahead. I've talked with them recently when I was visiting Hong Kong last month, and there are determined people there that will go and fit in. It will happen if the government does not make promises for universal suffrage by 2017. The government has to, by their own rules, come out with a plan for the election in 2017. So the nut has to crack one way or another. And if that plan does not allow for universal suffrage, then there's no doubt in my mind at all that some of the leaders in this group will go and sit down in Central, and quite a few of the populace are likely to join them. So I do think it will happen. Yes, I don't have a crystal ball, but that would be my guess.
Well, I remember during the Edward Snowden period when he was in Hong Kong, we were trying to figure out what was going on there, and I spoke with the head of PEN, the writers' human rights group, PEN, in Hong Kong, to get it. I think he'd actually met with Snowden, or he had some knowledge of what was going on at the time. But he brought up the influence of the Chinese government at the time and said, you know, there's this huge building in the middle of a town that has no windows, that has endless numbers of people in it, and it's all the Chinese Intelligence Bureau. And, you know, China has a tremendous presence there, but it's sort of subtle yet menacing.
This is part of the ambiguity I referred to a moment ago in the agreement between London and Beijing in the 1980s. The formula that says one country, two systems refers on the face of it to economic systems, the socialist system in the mainland and the capitalist system in Hong Kong. And what is left ambiguous in that formula is how much the political systems will be separate. And, of course, the Hong Kong Democrats and most of the Hong Kong people want the implication of one country, two systems to mean two political systems are different, too. But in Beijing, quite a few, including the ones at the top, are leaning on the other end of that, and they're saying, no, one country, two systems refers to two economic systems, but politically, you're all in the same bag. You're all, we are the sovereign in Beijing, and Hong Kong is part of the territory over which we're sovereign. And if push comes to shove, we're in charge. Now, this particular conflict has been especially intense with Hong Kong's lawyers. Hong Kong has a very strong, inherited from the British, this is one good thing the British did, is leave an independent judiciary behind. And the Hong Kong Bar Association recently has come out with a very strong statement countering the claim that ultimate sovereignty in Beijing means that Beijing has final say over legal decisions in Hong Kong. There's a court of final appeal that's set up in Hong Kong after the Hong Kong left the British. It used to be that final appeals were sent to the Privy Council in London. And after 1997, to replace that, there's a court of final appeal in Hong Kong. And the Hong Kong legal community is solidly behind the view that that is the final authority. But Beijing is saying, no, we are the final authority.
Well, Perry Lake, again, is he holds a chancellorial chair for innovative teaching across disciplines and is also a professor of comparative literature and foreign languages at the University of California, Riverside. He's one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people. And in the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked from the Politburo by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform students' protest in June of 1989. And he was blacklisted by the Chinese government in 1996, and he joins us from Taiwan. So turning to the meeting that took place last weekend between President Xi of China and a high-level delegation from India and Myanmar, the Chinese president made a photo op where he said, China does not subscribe to the notion that a country is bound to seek hegemony when it grows in strength. Hegemony or militarism is not in the genes of the Chinese. China will unswervingly pursue peaceful development because it is good for China, good for Asia, and good for the world. So is that charmer fencing working with the neighbors? Because I believe a number of the neighbors in the South Asia in particular are quite nervous about China.
Yes, that's politicians' rhetoric, essentially. The actual events on the ground, or we should say on the water primarily, are with Japan over disputed islands, and with both the Philippines and Vietnam over islands and oil, mineral resources in the South China Sea. And there have been just plain military conflicts here, especially with Vietnam. The ramming and actual sinking of some small Vietnamese boats has happened. So those three countries in particular not only are nervous, they've had conflicts in the last few months with China. And when the Chinese officialdom, I saw a quote from a professor at Nanjing University yesterday speaking essentially for the Chinese government and was asked, you know, why is it that China can be peacefully rising at the same time that these conflicts are going on? And his fairly indefensible answer was to say, oh, it's the other countries that are starting this, which, of course, leaves the puzzle of why three different countries at once are having problems at the same time. So there certainly is a new sort of belligerence coming out of Beijing towards its immediate neighbors, among whom, of course, Myanmar or Burma is one. It's pretty close. India is a little farther away, but in the not too distant past, China has had conflicts with India as well. So I think when you hear this rhetoric from the top, from Xi Jinping, you have to just view it as rhetoric. It's political language with a goal of trying to soften certain people and achieve, through soft power, a kind of goal. But what one really needs to do is analyze what's actually happening. And my view is that it's true. I wouldn't use the metaphor Chinese genes, but I don't feel in my gut that the Chinese military, aggressive as it is going to be expansionist in the same sense that Japan was in the early part of the 20th century. It's not going to start taking over Asia, but it does really want its immediate neighborhood to be in its control, and the immediate neighborhood expands both eastward and southward in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, and towards a power a little bit more distant like India. Beijing hopes for respect, almost fealty. We are the number one guys in Asia, kind of a feeling. That for sure, I think, is part of Beijing's agenda, but I don't see any signs that Beijing might want to invade India or Burma. Well, for Burma, of course, one has to realize that China has needed access to the Indian Ocean. And there have been projects, this isn't really clear in my mind right now, but building an oil pipeline from China down to the Indian Ocean through Burma and things like that. Shipping.
Well, there was also the big dam project that was cancelled because the Burmese finally woke up and realized that the Chinese are going to divert all of their water back to Indochina, and they become a desert in the jungle. And that apparently irritated China, the cancellation of that project. I'm not sure that the oil pipeline, which was a twin project, has actually gone through as well. When President Xi, Perry Link, said in his charm offensive to leaders from India and Myanmar over the weekend, it seems like a pretty clear dig at the United States. He says, the notion of dominating international affairs belongs to a different age, and such attempts are doomed to failure. Given what you just said, does that mean that if the United States is the irritant, what do you think China's plans are in terms of if the military, as you say, are not really aggressive, but they like to be able to dominate the neighborhood? What are the South Koreans and the Japanese are going to say? And, you know, given that we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of World War One, you'd hate to see another war break out because push comes to shove over these islands with, you know, the Japanese and the Koreans having the history that they have with China, particularly the Japanese. You know, what role do you think that the U.S. is going to play? It'd be better, wouldn't it, to calm things down than be a problem?
it's visible, especially in the last year, that Japan and Korea and even Vietnam and the Philippines have all turned to the U.S. For a soft umbrella in this. And then it was about 4 years ago that the Obama administration made a famous basic policy decision, that they called the pivot, that meant that in military and diplomatic terms especially, a focus would be more in Asia for U.S. foreign policy rather than in the Middle East, which, of course, has been preoccupying U.S. foreign policy for a long time. And when this word came out that there's a pivot to Asia, Beijing got very, very nervous. What does that mean? Does that mean us? And I think from an objective point of view, we have to say, yes, it did mean Beijing. I mean, let's not play games here. Washington was worried about the rise of China. And
so the Chinese were the only ones that haven't been included in the TPP. I'm afraid we've run out of time, Perry Link, but I really appreciate you joining us from Taiwan.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Perry Link, who is professor of Chinese literature and languages at the University of California in Riverside, and he was a recipient of the Tiananmen Papers leaked by a high-level Chinese official that led to him being banned by the Chinese government in 1996. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.